Hello and welcome to all my fellow resilient rainy day hikers. I'm your host, Meredith Meeker, and this is another episode of How Do I Do This, an environmental career podcast. We just had our first thunderstorm of the year, and I love thunderstorms. I think it is important to remember how powerful and awe-inspiring nature really is. And now that we are fully in spring mode, hopefully there will be more thunderstorms coming. However, my chat with this week's guest was recorded all the way back at the beginning of the year, so we were still enjoying all the fun our Canadian winter has to offer. Our guest this week is Brian Poirier. Brian is the Manager of Strategic Conservation Policy in the Canadian Wildlife Service, a branch within Environment and Climate Change Canada. In that role, Brian and his team work to ensure that biodiversity policy and considerations are incorporated into other government priorities and initiatives, including those related to climate change. So let's get right into it. We are so happy to have you here today, and I wanted to start this off on this beautiful, snowy winter morning. Do you have a favorite place you like to get outside, explore, and connect with nature?
There's lots to choose from. We're really lucky. We live just a little outside of Ottawa on the Quebec side of the river. And so we have, you know, one end of our street, we have Gatineau Park, and the other end of the street, we have the Gatineau River. So we're a bit spoiled here, but that makes for lots of great opportunities to get out for skis and for skates and for mountain bike rides and so forth in the summertime. So that's kind of the go-to place, if you will. But this year, as a bit of a COVID coping strategy, we have three little ones. We decided to build a backyard rink. This is our first go at that. But it's been one of the things that's really, really impressed me about that is that it really helps you to make peace with winter. You know, you're getting excited about minus 15 because the ice is going to be amazing, or you're out there at night at 8:30 shoveling or what have you. And I mean, you're just spending time outside at night in the winter, which is something I didn't do a lot of before having a backyard rink. So it's a real treat, and it's sort of a different way to, I guess, connect with nature in your own backyard. It's kind of nice.
Yeah, I think it's really important right now to find those special ways to connect with nature close to home. So backyard rink sounds pretty cool and very lucky. I never had one growing up, but my best friend, they did one every year, and we would spend hours out there, and I don't know the last time that I've done that.
Yeah, it's been a hoot, and I've learned a lot about ice. I didn't realize how much I didn't know about ice. There's a lot to know.
So, Brian, you work for the federal government, right?
Yeah, it's Environment and Climate Change Canada. You're absolutely there we right. go. Yeah, and within the department, there's several branches that focus on different environmental issues. The branch that I'm part of is the Canadian Wildlife Service. So we're responsible, as you might imagine, for wildlife issues, but also biodiversity, some protected areas, migratory birds, things of that nature.
So with the Canadian Wildlife Service, can you tell us a little bit more about your role and why it is what you do is so important, really?
Right.
Small questions.
Yeah, that's right. We'll starting off with the easy ones. Good. So I manage a small team in the Wildlife Service, and we focus on conservation policy, strategic conservation policy, if you will. And what that means is a lot of our time goes towards looking at interconnections between what you might think of quickly as conservation or wildlife-oriented policies, for example, and others that perhaps are worked on in other federal departments or that provinces and territories or others might be leading. And I find that space between policy initiatives is a really fertile place to be, because there's often interconnections that are not immediately apparent. So it's really quite exciting work to be able to think not just about the Species at Risk Act, but how that might interact, for example, with an agricultural framework or policy that's being developed, or, you know, something related to impact assessment or whatever it is. It's the interconnections between those things is really where that strategic conservation policy piece comes in. And so I find that quite rewarding. And I think it's quite important, because we don't always focus on what the implications might be of those interactions between policies.
Yeah, I think something that's come up on this podcast now multiple times is how, yeah, people who work in conservation and the environment, we all know the score. We all know what's going on with the environment. But we need more than people who are just working in the environment to know what's up. And we need to be working with the agricultural sector and the transportation sector and even the financial one so that, you know, everybody's interests are being addressed. And that's the only way we're really going to move the conservation agenda forward, is by working together. So it's basically a long-winded way of saying, yeah, it sounds like you're doing some really important work.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with your comments about, you know, connecting your work to sectors and to the private sector and included to finance, et cetera, and so forth. It all does tie together, and it needs to. Yeah.
So, Brian, could you tell us a little bit more about your journey and how you got to where you are now? I'm curious if you have any experience with some of those other sectors, or, you know, what's kind of shaped your direction?
Sure. So, I mean, it's a pretty windy road. I don't know how far you want to go back. I think probably, like, I'm always fascinated. Most of my colleagues that I work with had some kind of influential experience as a kid in the outdoors, either, you know, maybe they went to a camp or family camping, or they spent time at a cottage or whatever. It was no different for me. I did a little bit of family camping and cottaging, and that, I think, sort of planted a seed. And by the time I got through high school to sort of university age, I knew I wanted to do something related to nature. I didn't know exactly what that was or even what the options were, frankly, but sort of set off down that path. I started out in undergrad studying environmental studies and environmental science with a minor in geography, and almost immediately flipped that. Geography, I realized, it was a whole new world when I got to the university level, and one that I really, really liked. It's such a diverse discipline. And, you know, you can be, you know, in hip waders in the stream in the morning at your fluvial geomorph class, and in the afternoon you're looking at the historical geography of Quebec or something. Like, it's really just diverse and exciting. And so it was a field that I really kind of fell in love with. So, and during undergrad, I also just sort of, not on the academic side, but I guess on the social side, met a lot of folks, outdoor types who are, you know, paddlers, birders, etc., who were interested in the outdoors, and that just kind of fueled that flame a little bit. From there, I did a bit of postgraduate training at Queen's. I was interested in outdoor and experiential education, so spent a bit of time in the education world, working as a teacher and training as well in that area. And then I had an opportunity in the early 2000s to go back to school full time and to do some research with a gentleman who was at the time the Canadian research chair in water governance, and water was an issue that had sort of captured my attention. So went back to school, did a PhD and a postdoc at Guelph and Waterloo, respectively, focused on water. And during that postdoc, I came across some information about a recruitment program for the Federal Public Service. It's called the Recruitment of Policy Leaders Program. So I applied into that, managed to make it through the written application and the interview process, and the rest is history. I've been with the Federal Public Service since then, so about 10 or 11 years now. Can I say, I will put in perhaps a plug for the public service. You know, at the time, I think one of the comms lines on the recruitment program was 300,000 jobs, one employer, to make the point that there's a lot of opportunity and variety. If you're interested, if you're a curious person and you like to work on different things, the public service might be a good bet for you, because there is so many different files. It was very refreshing for me to come to Ottawa for interviews, and people would say, you know, what do you want to work on? And I would launch into, you know, well, for my PhD, I did this, and my postdoc, I did that, and I focus on water. And I'd finish, and they would invariably say, thanks. So what do you want to work on? You know, and like, what? I'm so, in the academy, you're quite, I think, become quite used to focusing on what it is that you're specialized in, and that alone. And to make a transition to a different area of study, for example, would require, you know, a sabbatical and working for several years to get, you know, published and recognized in a new field. It's quite difficult. Whereas in the public service, I mean, I've had the wonderful opportunity to work on things that, from, you know, terrestrial biodiversity to cumulative effects, impact assessment, Arctic files, oceans files, etc. These are not things I necessarily train for in terms of subject matter, but was able to make a contribution in those areas and to learn a lot along the way, which suits someone like me very well, who's, I think, a fairly curious person. So I should say, though, while I'm on the topic of the public service, and I think you and I discussed this before, but today I'm just going to be speaking from my personal perspective, not any kind of official capacity or speaking on behalf of the department or anything like that. It's just sort of my personal views.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Brian. And so that program is still available and people can, you know, apply?
Yeah, absolutely. So there is a narrow window of opportunity that opens up for applications. It's usually in October. It's about a 2-week window. So, and the written process, the written application process is, I think, relatively rigorous. So people probably want to start preparing stuff in advance, maybe in September or even late August or something. But I'd encourage people to check it out. It's really geared towards graduate students who are wrapping up degrees, particularly those who have perhaps won a major award like an NSERC or a SHRC or something to that effect. And yeah, it's a fantastic program. I couldn't speak more highly about, or highly enough about it. And I'd recommend that folks, if that sounds like something of interest, to have a look at it and just be as ready as you can be when the window opens for applications in the fall.
So mostly open to master's students and above.
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I'm sure there's a lot of people listening who are, you know, master's is coming up, you know, there's the end is near and they're wondering what to do next. And yeah, that's kind of a scary position to be in. I know I was very nervous when I finished school. So definitely good to have some opportunities in your back pocket.
And I think those feelings, certainly that was the case for me too. I mean, when this opportunity presented itself to come to Ottawa and Gatineau and work in the federal public service, I in my brain, I thought this would be like a 2-year kind of a postdoc. That's how I was treating it. I'd come, I'd learn how government works, and then I'd, you know, perhaps apply that elsewhere. And no one was more surprised than I was to learn that I really love it. And I think a big part of it was that variety and that openness for someone like me to explore different subject areas, all environment related, but different files that I might not otherwise have been touched had I gone down a different career path.
And so do you have any advice that you wish you could go back and give yourself when you were starting out your career, or that you'd want to give somebody who's leaving school now?
Yeah, sure. So I think for me, I probably could have worked harder, even harder than I did, to develop transferable skills. So clearly, as someone who's in university doing like a 4-year undergrad or a master's degree or something to that effect, there's lots of opportunities to hone your research skills, for example. And that's going to be part of, I think, most programs if you decide to do a major research paper or a thesis or something to that effect. But sort of what I mean by transferable skills, so there are those research skills, I suppose that is transferable, but other skills that even now it's something I work on daily is writing. I mean, the ability to communicate effectively in writing and orally, but particularly in writing, is probably one of the skills most required in my line of work. And it's something that, I mean, I'll always be a student of, working away at that. Organization is another one, that sort of executive function, if you will. I had a prof when I was doing my PhD, and he once said that, you know, two types of people make it through graduate school: those who are brilliant and those who are very well organized. And I'm not sure I was either of those, but I certainly took the message to heart. And I think being organized certainly does help. If you're brilliant, congratulations. But for the rest of us, I think organization goes a long way. That's certainly helpful. Other things, if the federal public service is something that is of interest, languages are an asset, particularly French if you're a native Anglophone, or English if you're a native Francophone. I probably could have spent more time. I certainly could have spent more time working on my language skills. It's not a requirement. It's not, the door is not closed if you're not bilingual, but it does help. And so that's probably something I would tell myself to focus on a bit more, perhaps, when I was in school. Funding applications is another one. This is something I did actually quite a lot of as a graduate student. You know, I wrote a lot of funding applications, and it was always something kind of done off the side of your desk, like, oh, I can't believe that one's due already. Or I'm trying to focus on writing my dissertation, but I need to write this application before the deadline, etc. Seemed like a bit of a nuisance at times. But in the process of writing those funding applications, you hone your ability to basically to make a pitch and to make it fast and get to the point. And lo and behold, I mean, that really becomes handy in a policy context in my world when you're trying to explain to, you know, either your senior management or to ministers or whomever about why it is important to move in a certain direction on an environmental issue. There's a lot of transferability between that sort of funding application. It's almost like having, some people talk about having the elevator pitch. I mean, the ability to sort of develop that really punchy, concise, succinct, this is what we need to do, this is why, here's the risks, here's the considerations. Just really nail that. That's something you learn to do when writing these funding applications as a graduate student. And there's certainly I've gotten a lot of mileage out of that skill set. So that's one I thankfully I did work on as a student, and I think is still, I think, serving me fairly well today. Maybe the last thing I'll mention is, and again, I apologize. I know some of your, not all your listeners are students at university, but that's who I was thinking about as I was preparing for our conversation today. If you have an opportunity to focus your work in a geographic location, and if place is something that matters to you, if you want to live in a certain area or focus your studies in that area. I was really interested in water allocation and particularly in semi-arid regions. So if I wanted to work in Canada, it was going to be out west. It was going to be in Alberta or Okanagan. I had colleagues working in Australia, et cetera. And invariably, we would come out of our programs and there would be opportunities for jobs in southern Alberta, in the Okanagan, in Australia, for things like, for example. But I'm also a person who is a bit of a sucker for the Canadian Shield. I like the Blue Lake and Rocky Shore, and my family's here in Ontario and Quebec. And so, I mean, it was wonderful to have those opportunities, and I learned a lot and met some great people out west. But, you know, had those same opportunities popped up, you know, had I done my focus, my research in Ontario or Quebec, for example, perhaps those opportunities would have come up here a bit more readily. So think about the connection between where you might do some of your research, particularly if you're doing field work, and where you might like to live after school.
Yeah, I hear you. I've mentioned before, but I lived with my sister when she was doing her master's, and she had a very cool master's. She got to do her field work scuba diving in Belize. But she didn't actually want to live anywhere in the tropics or anywhere near a reef. So then coming back and applying that, you know, she had to do a little bit of extra work. I mean, mind you, she's found those transferable skills and she's doing very well for herself, but there was definitely a few extra steps in there to make it kind of work.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it for sure.
Yeah. And actually, I also want to go back to your funding statement because, as a, you know, working with LE, oh my gosh, it's early. I'm just going to
It is
edit this
early.
out. Working with ELB, we're always putting in funding applications, and that's a skill that we look for. And so, if you can't get it through your master's or through school, there's a lot of NGOs that would really like your help with funding applications, and that's going to help you. Even if you're not going into government, if you're going to NGOs or even consulting, there's so many proposals. So, really, really great skill if you can get that early.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Yeah. And you know, I had some really strong profs in the departments I was a part of, affiliated with in university, and I remember one in particular who you know didn't at all work in my area of expertise, but was reviewing the applications that students had developed for before they left the department. And he basically took, like, it was a one page description of what of my work and why it was important and so forth. And he just basically came along and, like, crossed off the top part of the page, everything about context, he crossed off, and he was like, get to the objectives, give me three, keep it simple, straight ahead. You know, like, that kind of advice is invaluable. And it sort of changed my approach. And there was a lot of success as a result of that. And I'll always remember that person and that advice very fondly. And, you know, you just, unless you do it a lot, and you happen to cross paths with people who do this for a living, it's a difficult skill to just, you know how to do well automatically. It's one you have to sort of cut your teeth on a bit. And so time spent doing that at university is a great, is time well spent, I guess I'd say.
So, Brian, great advice. Thank you. I also want to go back to, I guess, a little bit more policy. We haven't actually been able to sit down with a lot of people who really helped shape policy. So, I was wondering if you could tell us, you know, if people are thinking about getting into this field or this aspect of conservation, what do you think people need to know about how policy influences conservation and the preservation of biodiversity?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm a bit biased based on the kind of work that I do. As I mentioned before, a lot of my work focuses on interconnections between policies, and what that requires is one to sort of get outside their wheelhouse, you know. So if you're the type of person who knows species really, really well, you may need to learn a bit about a different policy context because there's likely connections between the two. So one, like, really, really fascinating space that I've had the good fortune to work in for the last few years is the relationship between climate change and biodiversity. And that's an area of work that's getting increasingly, it's getting a lot of oxygen these days. You know, I think I probably read the term nature-based climate solutions every single day, but it's a fascinating space in that one would think, or one might think, that things that are good for climate change are good for species, and things that are good for species are good for climate. It's not necessarily always the case. And sometimes there are interactions between the two that really need to be fleshed out and looked at carefully, because there often are opportunities for win-wins. But until those are sort of brought to light, those sort of collateral benefits can certainly be missed. So again, sort of thinking in that climate change and biodiversity space, you know, like there is a risk of you know, well-meaning policies, perhaps in a climate change space, for example, to unintentionally have cascading effects or implications for biodiversity, right? So things like, you know, if you are converting like a non-forested landscape to that happens to be of high biodiversity value and offers a lot of ecosystem services to a forested landscape, you know, to help with carbon sequestration, but a forest of low biodiversity value, that's not necessarily a good deal for biodiversity for species. Or, you know, if you're building or siting wind turbines or solar farms, obviously there'd be need there to think through what are the implications for migratory birds and for bats and at certain times of year, and can, you know, these sort of clean tech and clean energy installations be operated in such a way that they're supportive of, you know, again, migratory birds, for example. So things like that, there's often those connections, but they're not necessarily immediately apparent. So, I mean, that's why I love the work that we get to do, which is to sort of dig into some of those interconnections. And, you know, as I said before, there really is an opportunity for win-wins if they can be sort of, you know, brought into the light. So again, sort of in that climate change and biodiversity space, like, there's great work out there on natural infrastructure projects, you know, that can often be used in place of or in combination with sort of conventional gray infrastructure, which has all kinds of benefits for, you know, for nature. It has the actual benefit of the infrastructure itself, you know, for human well-being, it's creating green spaces, you know, other things. Like, obviously we're at a point in this country where indigenous rights and values are something that's incredibly important, and reconciliation is a high priority. And so oftentimes there's opportunities to link the conservation agenda with Indigenous reconciliation. So a nice example there is we're starting to see in Canada now the emergence of Indigenous protected areas or protected and conserved areas. So again, this is sort of, you know, two important areas of policy work that kind of come together. And that's what I find quite exciting. So looking at the space in between those seemingly distinct initiatives is probably a good practice, and certainly something that's pretty exciting to me.
Yeah, that is very exciting. It's, you know, like we talked about, it's important to be able to bring in different fields and different ways of thinking. So that's awesome.
I agree.
Okay, so that's the exciting part. But what's the most challenging part of your job, or maybe the most unexpected part when you started working?
So I think the challenging parts of my job, so I think some of them certainly are, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, I'm a bit of a curious person, and there's no end of fascinating topics to dig into and to explore. Usually the only limitation is time. And so that's a challenge. I mean, I have the luxury of working with a lot of bright and very inspiring people who are doing really fascinating work and work that I'd love to learn more about, but one has to marshal their time a little bit and sort of focus on sort of core responsibilities at times. So it's a bit of a treat to have exposure to those ideas, but at the same time, you have to kind of just discipline yourself a little bit. But I would say that more recently, I mean, my job now has switched a bit from really working as a subject matter focused analyst to more of being focused on people, perhaps more than the files. I manage a small team now, as mentioning earlier, and so working with those with that team and supporting that team is probably the best part of my job, but it can also be the most challenging part, as I'm sure a lot of folks who are in similar situations and managing teams, this may resonate with them, is that you don't always have the tools to be able to support those people in the way you'd like, and so that can be a bit challenging and a bit bit frustrating, particularly now during the pandemic. I'm sure that, in all sectors in across the country, people are certainly feeling at this stage. I mean, we've been in this sort of pandemic mode for about a year or close, coming up on a year, I guess. And that's wearing on people. That's grating on people. And so when your job is to try to support people and really think through how you can help to support people's mental health during difficult times like this, that becomes it's a challenge. Let's put it that way. It's a challenge, and one that certainly occupies more and more of my thought of late. So that's one of the bigger challenges at the moment. I know it's not tied necessarily to biodiversity. It's tied to my colleagues and my teammates who work on biodiversity, but it's one that's front of mind for me right now.
I mean, that makes total sense. And I also think, you go through the education and your training and, all of your early years of your career, and they're usually focused on subject matter. And then you get to a point where now you're a manager, and, we don't have those years of training necessarily for management. So it can be probably a little bit of a difficult transition for some people. And, it sounds like you've got the best interests of your team at heart, and I don't know if you could ask much more from a manager than
Well,
that.
that's that. Thank you. That's forgiving. And we're I think we're muddling through. I hope we are. And I hope everyone is. I mean, we'll all get through this, I hope so.
Yes, and hopefully, the last lockdown is behind us, and vaccines are coming, so there is hope.
Things are looking up. It's true. Yeah.
So you did mention, working with the team is one of the best parts of your job, but are there others, or what are your favorite parts of your job?
Yeah, I think it's two sides of the coin. I mean, for that question of what's the most challenging part and the question of what's the best part, it's really the same stuff. I mean, it's fantastic in my mind that I get to work with my colleagues who, they're quite a bright bunch. My kudos to my bosses who have assembled a team of really interesting and inspiring folks. So that's fantastic. But the flip side of that coin is there's too many tantalizing things to ever possibly focus on. So you have to sort of pick and choose a bit. And then, again, I think probably one of the most rewarding parts is working with my team, but also a challenge, particularly in light of the current circumstances we find ourselves in. There's certainly some challenges around that, and in terms of trying to help people to maintain their mental health when during the pandemic.
And so I know maybe not everybody's hiring right now because of the, funding or just how things are in the world right now. But if you're looking for a new team member, like what do you look for? Is there a particular skill set that, will help somebody succeed in your group?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a few ways to go about this. So typically, if I'm advertising for a position, I think perhaps it goes without saying at this day and age, a university degree is kind of standard, I would say. Oftentimes, graduate studies are an asset, but not required. I mean, if you're someone who's done an undergraduate degree and you put a lot of effort into it and you really developed your those transferable skills we talked about earlier, like the for example writing, communication, etc., really well and can demonstrate that, then that's you can certainly clear that bar with an undergraduate degree. People shouldn't feel the need to go out necessarily and do graduate degrees, although for someone like me it probably took those graduate degrees to hone my skills enough to be able to make a contribution. Other people are brighter and faster than I am, though, so may get there in just 3 or 4 years of undergrad. So that's one thing. Experience in terms of I'm look and for the type of work that I do in a policy shop, researching and analyzing complex environmental issues, some experience in that area is, I would say, necessary. Some knowledge of how government works. Clearly, if someone's coming into government first job, they're not going to know the ins and outs of to an exhaustive level of detail. But that said, one can sort of get a fairly quickly get a sense of what is it that public servants do relative to the political side of a government, and how does the sort of the policy process work? I mean, one can sort of dig into that a little bit and just have a sense of how government works. That's quite a handy skill set. One people will certainly learn on the job, but it's helpful to have at least a base understanding of that coming in. In terms of abilities, again, I mentioned that identify like the ability to analyze complex issues, as I think your listeners will appreciate environmental issues tend to be complex. And so the ability to work with that kind of material is certainly an asset. Again, I'll come back to the communicating effectively, both in writing and orally, verbally. Often, I mean, I would say the vast majority of my work is done in writing, but as you begin to move up, and certainly that's the case for junior level analysts, for example, but as you begin to move up, there are increasing opportunities for oral briefings, for that elevator pitch and being able to communicate your ideas quickly and effectively. So those are skills I would look for. And I mean, the ability to manage oneself and to manage multiple tasks under pressure. There's a lot of oxygen these days, certainly on the biodiversity file. It's very exciting, and things are fast paced. And in fact, they've been that way for quite a while. They're particularly so of late, but just being able to manage oneself, to reprioritize, to triage what the priorities are in any given moment, that's really going to help people to perform well in that kind of work environment where there's a lot going on. Personal suitability, things that these are a bit tougher to, these are the sorts of things that you try to assess with evidence. It's kind of that show don't tell piece, but you know, effective interpersonal relationships. In a policy context, you need to work with other people, as in you know, in many other contexts, scientific, academic, etc. So that's important. Initiative to be a self-starter, that goes without saying. The ability to exercise good judgment, reliability, these kinds of sort of standard things I think most employers would be looking for in any employee, almost regardless of the field. Attention to detail, and I mentioned earlier, those strong organization skills. There may be some forgiveness for those who are brilliant, but otherwise we got to be really organized. And so that comes back in. The last thing I'll mention is, I mentioned it before, but I'll just come back to it, is language skills. And so again, if you're listening to this and you're like, well, this all sounds very interesting, but I don't speak a word of French, or I don't speak a word of English. I don't know that this podcast would ever be translated, so I assume it's the former, not the latter. But that the door's not closed. But certainly the opportunities, I think you might have an easier time if you can sort of begin to develop some of those skills in both French and English. I think that would be quite helpful in the federal public service, I would say, and certainly in the national capital region. That would be an asset. Not to say that people need to be, you know, have a high level of proficiency right off the bat, but even a demonstrated ability or willingness to learn and digging into that material, that would certainly help, and help you communicate as well to your colleagues in the workplace who perhaps have a different native language than you do.
And there's so many, like, if you're not in school, there's so many apps and, you know, free apps that you can use to help learn a new language that are actually quite fun. So it doesn't seem like it takes too much work, but it's something you could do to help make yourself stand out. And I also think it's interesting, your point about knowing how government works. I feel like it's a good idea to know how your government works. And I think it's funny, it's something that affects our everyday, but we, you know, don't necessarily dive into what's going on. So maybe that's a little homework for everyone listening.
I'm certainly still a student of it and learning as I go, sort of thing. But it's good, again, just to have at least a foundational sense of that, I think, would be quite helpful.
Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming that when you guys put out a job posting, you guys probably get inundated with, you know, applicants. So do you have any advice for someone wanting to make their application stand out? I know it's a little bit different when you're applying for a government position, but are there certain things people need to hit?
Well, that's a great point right off the bat, is that it is a bit of a strange world when you're applying into a public service job, or at least in the federal public service. So I think understanding that hiring process and how it works would be really, really helpful to just help a person to, you know, orient what they're working on, the elements of their application to the process. So an example would be, I mean, I have heard of processes whereby the person who's doing the initial screening, so going through that, you know, the hundreds of resumes to sort of figure out who meets the qualifications and who doesn't, that person may or may not have, so let's say you're applying for a job that's related to biodiversity, the person who's doing that initial screening may be in an HR department and have no background in biodiversity. So, I mean, if you start to use synonyms, you know, if you use the word nature instead of biodiversity and the job description says biodiversity, someone might not know that when you say nature, you mean biodiversity, and you know, you could accidentally be screened out. So it could be almost like what are the key words? What's in the poster? I need to use that language and adopt that in my application because, again, the person screening it may or may not have background in this area. So that learn as much as you can about the hiring process that you're applying into. I would say that is the take-home message on that one. Agonize over the writing when you're in any competition where there's a lot of applications. You know, you want it to be as close to perfection as you can, really. The writing should be, you know, excellent. No typos, things of this nature. Just perhaps that goes without saying, but I would spend the time, agonize over the writing, have someone who's writing you admire look at it and provide you feedback. I tell my own team this when they're applying into pools or competitions. Never ask anyone if they can give you a reference. Only ask them if they can give you an outstanding reference. If there's anything less than 10s all the way down the board, that's a red flag. And so lots of people will, when you ask them, will say, sure, I'll write you a reference. But that's not what you need. You need the outstanding reference that's going to make you stand out. And references matter when people get to the reference check stage in a competition. So ask that right up front. Can you write me an outstanding reference letter? And that's a different question than just, can you write me a reference? What else? I would say, again, in the context of the public service, look at, there's different doors, right? So you can apply into a job that's posted on the GC Jobs website, for example, but there's also recruitment programs like the one I mentioned about the recruitment of policy leaders. So poke around, have a look, and look for those other sort of avenues that might help you to get a foot in the door. Placements. We work with a lot of students, Environment and Climate Change Canada, and they bring a lot to the teams that they work on. And I think the brightest, most promising students we've had would say, treat it like a 4-month interview. If you're there on a placement, you know, do everything you can in that time to leave them no choice but to hire you. And if the manager you're working for doesn't have a position, you know, impress them so much they want to ask their colleagues at their level who's got an opportunity because this person is gold. We need to keep them. So treat it like a 4-month interview effectively and just go really hard when you do get a placement in a department. I think that would be helpful. And then the last thing for those folks who are in universities, there are services offered on your campus that they're woven into that massive tuition you've been paying that a lot of people don't take advantage of, but really should. Student services along the lines of, you know, resume prep, mock interviews, if you know, that sort of thing. A lot of universities have an office that where there are folks who are skilled at this and do it professionally, who can help you prepare. And so if you're at school still and you're paying tuition, you've got a right to access those services, and you should, because they can be quite helpful.
Yeah, I do not think I took advantage enough of all of those student services when I was in school. And yeah, it would have been very helpful.
I didn't wise up to it until fairly late in the game, but I mean, it was very helpful to do. Mm-hmm. I just definitely recommend it.
So we're going to switch gears a little bit. We're going to move quickly away from the job portion of this. And I want to hear about your favorite Nietzsche moment. We call it Nietzsche because nature is so neat. So either a moment while you were at work or just out exploring on your own.
So the one that comes to mind, which is giving me a lot of hope this week, we have a little ski trail quite close to the house here. And so I put in a ski some mornings when I'm organized enough and get the kids on the bus in time. And earlier this week, I heard my first cardinal, who had sort of changed to his spring song, that sort of wheat, 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 that sort of territorial song, which to me is, you know, groundhogs be damned. The early indicator of spring is when the cardinal switches his song. And so I heard for the first time this spring, I heard the cardinal earlier this week. And so that was a pretty neat and exciting moment for me. As much as I mentioned earlier, I'm, you know, having a lot of fun with this backyard rink. I'm always happy to see spring come too.
Yes, I've also noticed the Cardinals have changed their song. And
have you? Oh, good.
It's really, well, I'm a birder, so I'm just like ready for more birds to come back and, you know, make those morning walks just a little more colorful.
So a friend of mine who's a birder tells me it's actually tied to the sunlight and to the increasing length of the days more than any indication of spring. But I'm not listening to that. I'm keeping my hunch that there's this connection between cardinals and as an early indicator of spring. one month away.
Okay, fingers crossed. I'm going to hold you to that.
Please don't.
So this question we've started asking this season, and we've been getting some really great responses, but I want to hear your take. If you could wave a magic wand and have everyone adopt a new environmentally friendly habit or even people have been saying a way of thinking? Like, what would it be?
I think I'd wave the wand and send everybody outside. You know, my sense is that, I mean, for people to care about the natural world, they first have to experience it and experience it, some sort of state of wonder or in it. It's, and we do a terrible thing oftentimes in informal, you know, education kills by degrees, they say. You know, we talk about, oh, here's all the problems and there's climate change and there's, you know, biodiversity is tanking and there's all these problems and how are we ever going to solve this? And what we should be doing is trying to cultivate that sense of wonder first. That's the seed. And then we can get into working on the complex problems and how we might go about solving that. So that's the kind of thing you can't read in a book. You have to experience that with your senses. So I would send people outside to get some dirt under their fingernails, I think.
That's great. And I actually hadn't really thought of it that way before. Yes, I know people need to go outside and, you know, have a love before they can want to protect it. But if you put all the doom and gloom ahead of that awe moment, all they're going to think of the environment is doom and gloom and why fight for it. Whereas if they see the magic that's still there, then you want to protect it.
Absolutely. I mean, I was on a call, this was quite early in the pandemic, it would have been, you know, 8 or 9 months ago. And it was with some senior public servants from across the country. And there was one who was speaking from a jurisdiction out west. And she said, you know, we've been trying in my department to, you know, through our comms groups and so forth, to really, you know, to bring to the front of people's minds the importance of nature and those connections to nature and why they're important. And we worked at this for years and years and years. And she said, you know, in 6 weeks, COVID did it like that. It was just all of a sudden we saw huge demand for accessing parks, for trails, for green spaces. People wanted to do like the full gamut of activities in the outdoor. People were calling for, certainly for camping permits, but also hunting permits. But people wanted to get into nature. They needed that. They became really important. And over the following months, we saw a huge uptick in the use of green space and protected areas, for example. So, you know, there is an important connection there. I was heartened to see that so many Canadians seems to resonate with so many Canadians. And I think it is important, you know, certainly for children, but for, you know, Canadians of any age, is to really try to plant that seed of that sense of wonder first before we try to tackle all the complex problems.
Yeah, I also know if you tried to get a bike this year or a kayak, like, good luck to you. They
no
were
kidding.
Sold out everywhere.
Try to buy skis in Ottawa, forget it, it's just not happening. Yeah.
All right, so thank you so much, Brian. Last question for you. We've already kind of talked about a lot of the different entry points into getting, you know, into the federal government or if you want to become a public service, but what if people want to learn more about what your group is doing? Like, where should they go? What should they check out?
Yeah, sure. So on biodiversity writ large, as I suspect a lot of folks will know, responsibility for biodiversity is really shared across this country. There's no one government responsible for all of it. And it's really, I mean, cooperation it's absolutely pivotal on biodiversity. And so there's a wonderful website that the federal government and provinces and territories all contribute to, focused on biodiversity and what Canada as a nation is doing vis-a-vis biodiversity, conservation and sustainable use. And it's called biodivcanada.ca. And I'd encourage people just to check that out as sort of a starting point on biodiversity specifically. I mentioned earlier that a topic that's getting a lot of oxygen these days is nature-based climate solutions, also known as natural climate solutions, or more broadly as nature-based solutions. It's a really exciting space and there's lots of attention on it. A lot of Canada's leading NGOs, for example, also governments and some industry leaders are working in that space. So you could start with some Google searches about any one of those terms, nature-based solutions, nature-based climate solutions, or natural climate solutions. There's also some great resources out of a research group called the Nature-Based Solutions Initiative. They're out of the University of Oxford, and it's their website is certainly worth a look. They've got a cache of some great resources there. If you're interested in learning more about the Canadian Wildlife Service, I'd recommend checking out, there's a canada.ca website where you could, again, just search Canadian Wildlife Service and learn a bit more about that branch, or about Environment and Climate Change Canada as a whole, the entire department. If you're looking for information about employment in the public service, I would steer people towards the Public Service Commission, and their website is a good place to start in terms of, I mentioned earlier, about, you know, learning that process for what's involved in trying to apply for a position in the public service, in the federal public service. That would be a good place to start. And then finally, I would really strongly encourage folks to check out that Recruitment of Policy Leaders program. If you're listening to this and you happen to be a graduate student and considering the public service as a possible career path, that's a great little program, and I'd encourage you to check it out.
All right, Brian, thank you so much. We're going to put all of those links in our show notes in case people didn't have a piece of paper and pen handy, so they can check them out later. Okay, so Brian, thank you so much for sitting down with us today. You know, first thing in the morning, it's really appreciated, and I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Me too. Thanks, Meredith.
A huge thank you to Brian for sharing his time and experience with us. It was really great getting to learn more about the policy side of things. And if you want to hear more stories like Brian's, don't forget to like and subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss an episode. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram to find out more about job opportunities and cool events. And your fun fact this week is about an animal that is pretty much as Canadian as it gets. The moose is the largest member of the deer family, and a male can stand a full 2 meters tall. If you have ever had the privilege of seeing one of these magnificent creatures in the wild, it was probably near or in water. They are great swimmers, but did you know they can dive up to 5.5 meters, sometimes even more, to feed on plants at the bottom of lakes? Pretty cool. I personally can't wait until it's warm enough to jump in a lake. All right, that's all from me. Talk to you again next week. Happy trails.